This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Saturday is World AIDS Day. In the 3 decades since the first World AIDS Day was launched to bring attention to the disease, big strides have been made in the treatment and care of HIV patients. Still, millions of people around the globe are living with HIV, and last year alone, nearly 2 million people were newly infected. So what work still needs to be done to stop the spread of HIV? How have attitudes to AIDS and understanding and awareness of the disease changed in the last 30 years? And what's being done in Florida to combat infection? Join the conversation at 1-866-338-5252, or you can send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. And with us in the studio is Joshua J. Myers. He's the Community Development Director at Orlando's Hope and Help Clinic. Hope and Help offers free HIV screening and other assistance for HIV patients. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by State Representative Renee Plasencia. He's a Republican representing District 50. He introduced legislation, House Bill 579, to set up a needle exchange program throughout the state by expanding Miami's needle exchange. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
And from Miami, Dr. Hansel Tooks is Assistant Professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Dr. Tooks is the Principal Investigator of the UM Harm Reduction Research Group, which houses the IDEA Exchange. It's Miami's pilot syringe access program. Dr. Tooks, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And with him as well is Austin Coy. She's a medical student at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. She works with Dr. Tooks at the IDEA Exchange, advocate for setting up a similar program in Orlando. Thank you as well, Austin.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me start with you, Dr. Tooks. The state has a couple of counties with some of the highest rates of new HIV cases in the country. Just give us a sense of what is causing this and some of the background to that.
Right. So Miami, where we are, has the highest rate of HIV infection in the country, and it's been that way for years. Unfortunately, Orlando has risen to the number two county in the country with the highest rate of new HIV infections. And this comes from many things. It comes from lack of comprehensive sexual education, lack of behavioral interventions to prevent infection, such as needle exchange. The entire country is reeling from a nationwide opioid epidemic, and we have this bread-and-butter intervention that has been shown to decrease rates of HIV infection by up to 80%. And unfortunately, Miami is the only place in Florida that has needle exchange. So in the state with such high rates of HIV, it's really incumbent on us to spread this program to other people in need.
Now, is this the primary way? Because obviously intravenous, needle use is not the only way the disease is spread. But you're saying this is probably like the best thing that other counties could do to help sort of stop the spread of HIV.
Well, we have many interventions to prevent the spread of HIV. So, of course, we know bread and butter is condoms. If we have better sexual education at early ages and we get condoms to people who need it, that would be one. One of the most effective tools, actually, that we have for preventing HIV infection is diagnosing new infection and getting people on treatment. Because when people are on HIV treatment, they can no longer spread HIV. And programs such as the IDEA Exchange, which tests our participants every 3 months, we're able to detect people when they have early infection, help get them on treatment, and help them remain adherent to their treatment plan. So that's more so than the clean syringes. Hmm. It's the fact that we're able to intervene early. That's what we really need in this state, is a more comprehensive testing plan so that we can link people to care.
So it's more than just a needle exchange. There's a lot more that goes to support the patients that you see and treat at the clinic.
Absolutely. So besides the exchange of clean syringes, which have been shown to prevent infection, we do rapid testing on the spot. Anybody who has a positive test is actually linked to care the same day. They're able to see a physician, get counseling, they get their labs done, and they leave that day starting their antiretroviral. So they're on the path to viral suppression. And as I said, once a month later, when they no longer have virus in their blood, they can no longer spread HIV. That early detection and linkage and suppression is going to be key to our control of the HIV epidemic in Florida.
There's been a lot of work done to develop new drugs and new treatment plans. And as you say, one of the key aspects of stopping the spread is to get people on treatment plans early, right? What about kind of awareness, though, amongst people who may be at risk of HIV/AIDS? What's your sense of how that attitude might have changed in the last 2 to 3 decades?
Well, I mean, obviously in the last two or three decades, we've made enormous progress in this epidemic. It's probably one of the largest successes that we've had in the modern era of medicine. But we have incredible tools to prevent infection. Like, apart from just behavioral interventions like needle exchange, we have PrEP. We have a pill that you can take every day to prevent HIV infection that is extremely effective, more effective than condoms. And we need people who are at risk to have better access to PrEP and more support in remaining adherent to this medication.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty on the eve of World AIDS Day, talking about some of the strides that have been made in prevention and treatment of HIV and understanding of AIDS, and also what work still needs to be done. The idea of a needle exchange in Miami, could that spread, or could that idea be rolled out across the state, and what impact would that have on HIV in the state of Florida? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Taking your questions and comments on Twitter as well, at WMFE Orlando. Joshua Myers, I want to bring you into this conversation. That statistic that Dr. Tooks mentioned at the top of our conversation, that Central Florida, the Orlando area, is now sort of number two, it's a little bit surprising. Is that something that you were aware of before?
It is surprising that we continue to climb to the top of the list. You know, when I first started in this, we were number seven, then we were number six, then we were number five, mm-hmm. and then now number two. And it might mean several things. First off, it might mean that we're actually testing more people and we're identifying those who might be positive and then linking them into care. And then it might also mean that people still are living, through a lens of blinders. You know, they're still affected by stigma with HIV, and they're still, not using condoms, not getting tested. They're still out there, kind of just doing what they want to do without having the education and access to the resources to stop the spread of HIV.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're on the front lines of this battle, right? You're trying to educate people. You're offering testing.
Absolutely.
Give us a sense of what you do and the kinds of folks that you help out here in Orlando.
Absolutely. So Hope and Help has been around for about 30 years, and we offer free HIV testing for everyone. If you do test positive for HIV, we link you immediately to our care system. And what that means is that we get you connected with a peer specialist, someone who's living with the disease, and they've successfully mitigated their way or navigated their way throughout their life with the illness. And then we get you connected with a case manager, and this is someone who helps you identify different resources in the community that can help you, live your best life. If you need assistance with getting pharmaceuticals and all medications, we get you connected with programs that can help you cover the cost of medication. Mm-hmm. We have a medical clinic as well, so we have primary care.
On the cost of medication, some of those drugs are quite expensive.
It's astronomical. There's lots of reports out there that indicate there could be from $3,000 to $8,000 a month. Hmm. And who has that, sitting around? Not too many people. So, mm-hmm. All the resources that are out there, we try to connect our folks with that.
What about stigma? You mentioned that as being a possible reason why we are seeing rates climb here in the Orlando area. Do you hear stories from the folks who come for testing or other kinds of help about, attitudes from others in the community, once they know that they have HIV?
We do. It's still understood that some people think that HIV is a gay white men's disease, and, it certainly isn't. Anyone who is sexually active or using needles, they're at risk for developing HIV. And when you look at the breakdown of demographics of those affected, you see a lot of African-American youths, you see a lot of Latino youths, both male and female, and there were also some Caucasian folks in there as well. But the perspective that I can't get this disease or that I'm invincible or I'm young, that's something that, I can just take a pill for and I'll be fine. We have to do away with those perspectives because it's just not healthy. It's not the right way to go about it. Mm-hmm. One has to value his or her life and have a conversation with those who you're sexually active with and make sure that both of you get tested and that you're aware of each other's status and you're using safer sex practices.
Renee Plasencia, let me bring you into this conversation. Dr. Tookes also mentioned something about the need for a more kind of coordinated statewide approach to not just like the idea of a needle exchange, but also other sort of treatment and accessibility of treatment and things. Now, tell me a little bit about the piece of legislation which you and a bunch of other lawmakers tried to introduce. It didn't quite make it through the gate, of course. But this was an idea of expanding this needle exchange that has been successful in Miami to the rest of the state. What happened with that legislation?
So it's difficult to get any legislation through, much less one that's somewhat controversial, as has been mentioned earlier. But when you take a look at what's happened with the bill, it was voted unanimously out of the first subcommittee, and it was voted almost unanimously out of the second committee, except for one person who voted no on it. So there is bipartisan support for this bill. The difficulties that we have in the legislature isn't necessarily in one chamber. It's typically when you're having to get something passed in both chambers. Mm-hmm. And although there might be good intentions with a lot of bills, oftentimes they get caught up in the overall chaos of what's happening in the legislature throughout our 60 days, because it's a very short window of time. There's a lot of different things that we're working on. And typically only about 15% of all bills that are filed become law. Last year was even more difficult. We had maybe about 5% of the bills. There was 3,200 bills filed, and only 200 bills became law.
That's not a very high runs per inning rate, or whatever the analogy is, right? I mean, it's you're right. It's got to be tough. So how do you kind of get more attention to it? Is that what it takes? You just have to get it get a champion in the Senate to help you out there? Like how do you do that?
Well, I want to say the biggest champions are the ones that are in our communities, and you've got them on the phone right now. You've got Dr. Tookes and Austin Coy, who is one of the three medical students that I was seeing on a weekly basis. And when you're talking about superstars, they are superstars. To see medical students fly up to Tallahassee from Miami on a weekly basis around their already difficult class schedule to advocate and lobby and push for a certain piece of legislation to pass it's inspiring. I told them when I was meeting with them at one point last year that they're going to make a movie about them one day. Because they're saving lives, they're changing lives, they're changing the direction of our state, and they're doing it because they care and that they understand. And that's where you're going to see the biggest change. What we need is more people from all parts of the state reaching out, emailing, making phone calls to their legislator, to the governor's office, because once it gets passed through the legislature, it needs to get signed by the governor. So you can't neglect that aspect of it either. But we need to get the Senate president to come tour the facility in Miami. Yesterday, the Speaker of the House went and toured it. And I don't think the House is the issue, because we've shown that we've been able to pass it from committee to committee. But typically, if we pass bills through committee and it hasn't moved in the Senate, then we don't hear the bill anymore, because there's a lot of bills that we need to hear. And if those bills are moving and another bill is not, then we don't want to take that spot because time is limited.
Do you have something in the books or something lined up to speak to the incoming governor to kind of get him on board with this idea?
That would be something that we would do. So typically you would have your advocates doing it as well. But for example, with this bill, what I would do first is I would meet with my leadership and make sure that we're moving it forward, and I'm 100% positive that we are, especially after yesterday's visit. Then I would reach out to my counterparts in the Senate, the ones that I have the best relationships with, and sit down with them and show them and explain to them why this is needed in our state. And if I have an opportunity of having a relationship with the Senate president, then I would do that as well. And then when I have my meetings with the governor, which I typically have a meeting with the governor twice before session begins, I sit down and I share my priorities with the governor personally. And this is one of the priorities that I would share with him.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty, on the eve of World AIDS Day, talking about the notion of expanding some of the ideas that have been tried out successfully in Miami to the rest of the state to cut down the infection rate of AIDS in the state of Florida, specifically a needle exchange, which is working in Miami at the moment. Austin Coy, I want to bring you into this conversation. High praise from Representative Plasencia there. no pressure, of course, but what is it that sort of got you interested in this, and what are you seeing at in your work, your studies down in Miami, that you think this idea could be expanded successfully to Orlando?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you so much, Coach P, for your kind words. It's really been incredible to work with such passionate legislators and physicians like Dr. Tookes. But this all really started when I started medical school. As you mentioned, I'm from Orlando, so I deeply love this community. And I came down to Miami here, and I started working at the Syringe Exchange. And when I went back home, I looked for similar things. If friends and family suffered from similar issues, everybody in the community has people that suffer from injection drug use disorder. And I found that in Orlando, there's really nothing like that. There's no place where people can go and get sensitive treatment. And that really bothered me, especially because Orlando, not only do they have the second highest rate of HIV, but they have the seventh highest rate of AIDS, which means that not only are people not getting diagnosed early, but they're also probably not getting as much treatment as they should be. Hmm. So Orlando has just as big of an issue as Miami does, and far less of the treatment.
And just to clarify, if you identify HIV early enough, you can actually put somebody on a treatment regime that they won't necessarily develop AIDS. Is that the way it works?
Absolutely. There's awesome treatment out there to suppress your viral loads. And that's another thing that's really special. Unfortunately, about Florida is that the rates of viral suppression are much lower than they are in places like New York.
Hmm. I wonder why that is. I've got a question coming in here from Twitter, and would be interested to hear what some of our listeners think about this issue as well, the idea of a needle exchange and other things to improve the treatment of HIV/AIDS in Orlando. We're at WMFE Orlando. You can give us a call, 1-800-1866-338-5252. Tweet here, thanks for having Dr. Tooks and Austin Coy on the air this morning. Harm reduction practices are much needed in Orlando. Can you ask the panel if there are any harm reduction practices used in Orlando currently? That sounds like a good question for you, Joshua. What do you know about harm reduction and what's going on in the Orlando area?
Well, there seems to be quite a bit going on, and you know, we want to provide an area for people to kind of get treatment and help at Hope and Help, you know, for HIV, and you know, if they're participating in activities that you know, put them and other people on a larger scale at risk, you know, we'd like for that to stop, and we'd like for them to get as much care as they need.
Mm-hmm. How do you get that message across to people? I mean, are some of the folks coming to you, this is just all new to them, they have no idea what's going on, you have to kind of educate them about
a
lot of things?
Yes, and it's kind of twofold. We see a lot of our younger folks come in and they're misinformed about HIV. For example, I talked to one 14-year-old, he's like, you know, if I have sex with a girl and the condom breaks, do I need to put on another one? You know, and I'm thinking, well, if you have to ask that question, you probably shouldn't be having sex. You know, so we're having to educate the youths and their parents at the same time, because a lot of parents don't believe that their kids are sexually active. You know, we're in the deep south here, so there's a lot of, you know, conservative thinking to where, you know, my kid is a good boy, she's a good girl, and they might be, but they are still kids and they're curious, and we can't be ignorant of that. So we have a campaign called Choose to Protect, to where we're out there on the streets. We go to a lot of the other clinics out there. We go to the prisons as well, and we test people. We educate people on safer sex practices. We also promote PrEP, and PrEP is a drug that, if taken consistently, you know, every day, it will be up to 88% effective at stopping a new HIV infection for someone who is HIV negative. And that's such a big win. I know it's available at our clinic, and it's available at other places. You can get that at hopeandhelp.org.
Hmm. Representative Plasencia, what about this notion then of other things? I mean, obviously, you've got to kind of pick your battles as a lawmaker, but the idea of maybe trying to put more effort into promoting sex education, for example, is that something that lawmakers like yourself are choosing to fight in the future?
I personally would. I mean, I was a high school teacher prior to becoming a legislator, and I taught mostly juniors and seniors. So when you talk about kids, you're talking about really they're adults at that point. I mean, mm-hmm. they're in that transitional time, that period in their lives when they are still kids to us, but they're already thinking like adults, and they are very curious. And you know, we would be doing a great disservice if we're not giving them all the information and all the tools needed for them to get through this life in a successful and a healthy way. But in addition to that, you know, when you take a look at any legislation, you want to be able to have long-term goals and be able to pass what you can during that time period. Passing needle exchange would be huge for our state. But then in addition to that, there are other policies that we need to pass, for heroin addiction and for HIV infections. Mm-hmm. And it could be having, you know, the rooms where you where users come and they use drugs, and having a safe space for them to be able to partake in you know, their addiction. And
is that a hard idea to get through to some folks? I mean, if you have a conservative bent, you might just think, well, law enforcement's the way to go.
Well, I think it's hard even if you're not conservative, because unless you have someone in your family or someone that's close to you who's an addict, mm-hmm. you don't understand the addiction, and you don't understand what it does. And so you're so far removed from it that something just seems like it doesn't make any sense, or it's counterproductive, or it's just not right. But if you really take time to understand it and to see the benefits of something and how it helps people, then you have a different mindset about it. I had never heard about this until I spoke with Dr. Tukes and Austin Coy about it and some of the other students. But it's not just that. It's not just those two intervention strategies, but there's a multitude of them. And in order to get all of them, you've got to start with one of them.
Mm-hmm. Austin Coy, can I bring you back into this conversation for a moment? It sounds like you're still fairly optimistic about this process and getting this this piece of legislation passed. Has any of your experience over the last kind of 12 months or so trying to advocate for legislation sort of turned you off? You still going to be back up there advocating for this in Tallahassee and helping lawmakers get something through so you can see something similar to what's happening in Miami on a statewide basis?
Absolutely. It's actually been really encouraging to work with legislators in this way, because the stigma is kind of that everybody's really kind of out for themselves and won't listen to ideas. But what we've seen is that when people are presented with the data, and with the data that we are saving lives and preventing HIV, there's really nothing controversial about it. And that is a trend that we hope will continue.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Tukes, your thoughts on the likelihood of a piece of legislation passing, or if that doesn't happen, other cities and municipalities just individually adopting something similar to what's happening in Miami?
I think that we have an amazing opportunity here. We have a program, a pilot program in Miami, that has shown to be extraordinarily effective in just 2 years. Tomorrow is the 2-year anniversary of the ID exchange that we have here. When we passed the pilot legislation, I really feel that it ushered in a new era of looking at HIV prevention in this state. And I'm extremely optimistic that we can spread this program statewide. You know, the overdose numbers just came out. Miami's numbers are going down. The rest of the state is going up. We were able to stop what could have been an HIV outbreak very early on this year, which is, you know, extraordinary. When Vice President Pence signed needle exchange in place in Indiana, it's mm-hmm. because they had 169 new infections. We had 10 new infections this year, and we were able to link those people to care and stop an outbreak of that proportion here in Miami. We've had tremendous success, and at this point, knowing how effective this program is, knowing how many people it helps, how many lives that it saves, we have no choice but to spread it to the rest of the state, or else we're withholding this amazing tool to a vulnerable population. And I'm sure that the legislature will get it right this time.
Well, Dr. Hansel Tukes is assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, principal investigator of the UM Harm Reduction Research Group housing the Idea Exchange, Miami's pilot syringe access program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Austin Coy, medical student at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, an advocate also for setting up a needle exchange program in Orlando. Austin, thank you as well.
Thank you.
State Representative Rene Plasencia, Republican representing District 50, he introduced a bill to expand a needle exchange program statewide. State Representative Plasencia, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Joshua Myers, the Community Development Director at Orlando's Hope and Help Clinic. Joshua, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, the state of gambling in Florida and music from Chris Nichols. Intersection is back in a minute.
Hi, it's Diane Rehm. You might not know this, but when I stepped away from my daily show, I started a podcast. It's called On My Mind. Each week I talk news, politics, culture. You can find On My Mind at dianerehm.org or subscribe on your favorite podcast app.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A U.S. Supreme Court decision over the summer opened the door to legalize sports betting. The court struck down a 1992 federal law that effectively prevented most states from legalizing sports betting. Some states have introduced legislation to allow sports betting, but Florida isn't one of them. For more on the state of gaming in Florida and what the recent approval of Amendment 3 by voters means, I spoke to Mark Dunbar. He's an attorney at Jones Walker, and his firm represents gaming interests. He's also an adjunct professor at Florida State University College of Law.
Florida certainly was in that category and could have legalized sports wagering and taken advantage of it, but the voters of the state of Florida in November decided to amend our Constitution to prohibit the expansion of gambling outside of a supermajority vote of the voters, statewide voters, in any type of gambling activity expansion, including sports wagering. So basically, if you wanted to have sports wagering in Florida, you would have to amend the Constitution and get an affirmative vote of 60% of the voters for that constitutional amendment, and then have the legislature come back and create the regulatory and taxation regime to have sports wagering in Florida. Basically, it's a very, very, very difficult threshold for anybody to meet for this sports wagering to be legal in the state of Florida.
What's your sense then, Mark Dunbar, of whether sports wagering is happening anyway, but just under the table?
Oh, well, there's no question. Florida is a robust sports wagering market. Billions of dollars in sports wagering action flows inside the state of Florida in an illegal fashion. It would be a very lucrative tourist offering if Florida legalized sports wagering. If you understand sort of what happens around Vegas sports wagering when they kind of had the monopoly, what you saw was a spike around the big sports season, sort of like March Madness or the Super Bowl, where people would choose to become Vegas tourists for the purpose of sports wagering. Hmm. And they might not go to Vegas any other time of the year. They might not be into table games. They might not be into slot machines. They might not be into the shows or the restaurants or anything. But they like to go and engage in sports wagering, and you see a significant spike in hotel rooms during the key sporting event periods. And that has been a very, very successful tourist recruitment model that Vegas has used over the years. Now, it might not be as compelling to go to South Dakota, for example, to watch the national championship game because you could bet sports wagering, but a lot of people would come to the state of Florida. We know we have a significant tourist economy, and sports wagering certainly would be a very, very nice addition to the various offerings that we have for tourists in the state of Florida.
Do you think, Mark Dunbar, that the companies that your firm represents, are they just likely to kind of pack up and head elsewhere, or is there some potential for working with the likes of the Seminole tribe to take advantage of potential for sports wagering if there's kind of a way around this constitutional amendment?
Oh, every major sports wagering operation in the world, really, is keeping an eye on the state of Florida to see what they would do. All the major outlets across the pond, which is, you know, has a much more mature sports wagering and online sports wagering market than we certainly have here. All of those major players are, you know, watching the large states, Florida, New York, Texas, Pennsylvania, Illinois, California, because that's where the significant liquidity is. And so, you know, they're paying attention, and I know that the Seminole tribe has developed relationships with sports wagering operators and other areas that they have casinos, like New Jersey, for example. The Seminoles operate a great casino up there, and they certainly have a sports wagering amenity because it is legal in New Jersey. And so they are aware of it, certainly. And I will tell you, the Seminole tribe is you know, we are very fortunate in Florida to have the Seminole tribe. They are one of the top gaming operators in the world. They control one of the elite tourist brands in Hard Rock in the world. And if you were to partner those brands with a sports wagering amenity, it would be a very, very lucrative industry that would benefit not just the Seminole Tribe, but the state of Florida and venues that would host a Hard Rock sports gaming experience. There's nothing to say that the state of Florida couldn't enter into an arrangement with the Seminole Tribe that allowed them to be the hub of the sports wagering operations for the entire state of Florida, but then have sports wagering rooms in major hotels in Orlando or in Clearwater or in Jacksonville or any place like that. There are lots of options that could be on the table so that you had not just the Seminole Reservation and the hotels at the Seminole Reservations benefit from it, but that they could essentially offer satellite facilities. So the wagering would occur on reservation under the legal compact, but you would be able to enjoy the sports wagering vibe at venues away from the mothership.
The counter-argument that you will hear, I mean, especially from the folks who are opposed to, you know, gambling expansion, people who supported Amendment 3, they will say, well, look, Florida's got enough going on anyway, and especially if you look at the tourism industry, they're like, people don't come here to gamble. They come here to go to Disney World. They come here for the beaches, et cetera. We just don't need gambling.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I will tell you, I don't know that gambling expansion is necessarily always the answer. I've had clients that have stood up, and I have testified in front of numerous committees and spoke to countless legislators and said, I am not asking, I'm not here in front of you asking for an expansion. I'm here to ask for certainty. The uncertainty is what freezes capital investment. If you create certainty and you say once and for all, what you see in Florida is what you get, and that's all that it's going to be, capital markets will move based on the certainty because you can price in the risk and you can then deploy capital. It's the uncertainty that holds people off and forces the money elsewhere.
Mark Dunbar is an attorney at Jones Walker. His firm represents gaming interests. He's also an adjunct professor at Florida State University College of Law. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Still to come, what is subconscious plagiarism? The late George Harrison found out the hard way when he had to pay out $500,000 after releasing the hit song My Sweet Lord. Chris Nichols joins us for a conversation about entertainment law and a performance. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando singer-songwriter Chris Nichols is in the studio with a song called Balance Beams and Fault Lines.
Don't go, crack the code. Things look smaller from the rooftop down. Turn around, the sky is falling down. It's heavy on my eyes forever. Daydream of what it means to find meaning in these tired hands. Can't stand all this circling. I'm dizzy. Well, lift me up. I'm reaching. Transcend heaven, when did the future get here? Unseen, balance beam, lead me anywhere. I'm drifting in and out like seasons. so I'll build a fault line and landslide to oceans, sing till days fall down like rain on my tongue. Mouth open in the rain is nothing new. Hear the town crackle and forget you're new. The time is a consequence for all you do. So won't you, so won't you try.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With us in the studio, Chris Nichols. He's a singer-songwriter. He's also a music lawyer and a professor of entertainment law at Forsyth University. So
yes.
You've got a job which kind of ties into your role as a musician. How do those two things work together, Chris?
Beautifully. They work together wonderfully. So I'm a musician, I guess, you know, first and foremost, or I was that, you know, for a long, long time. And then I went to law school and decided to focus on entertainment law. And luckily, you know, I'm working at Full Sail now, which is fantastic. And I teach copyright and publishing over there. So they all sort of mix really well. You know, I get to teach students that are also, you know, in love with music, that love music and want to be a part of the industry. So I can share both my sort of business, you know, insight. And then also my love of the creative process. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to tie the creative process into copyright law because they sort of go hand in hand, right? Like, when does influence become ripping someone off?
Right.
You know, so I like to sort of throw that idea out there and, you know, have students think about that a little bit.
When you're writing songs, do you ever have that thought in the back of your mind, this could be a riff or something that I've heard somewhere else? How do I make sure this is completely original?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't know. I try to, you know, obviously be as original as possible. And if I feel like something is sounding too familiar, I tend to steer away from that. But there's a famous case where George Harrison plagiarized or whatever he copyrighted. He infringed on the Chiffons song. And anyway, it's a famous case, and he didn't even know it was subliminal copyright infringement, right? So he just wrote a song that sounded like good, kind of what you're saying, like, oh, that sounds right, that sounds good. And then he got sued, you know,
really?
And lost.
And now what was the song?
So his song was My Sweet Lord. Mm-hmm. And the song, the Chiffons song, was He's So Fine.
Uh-huh.
Right? So they came out like 7 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess, probably the most famous subliminal copyright infringement case that there is out there.
Mm-hmm.
And copyright infringement is kind of interesting because intent is not a requirement, right? So for various things, you have to intend. So even though he didn't intend to, you know, steal from them or whatever, infringe them, he still met the elements there. So
and there's been some fairly high profile cases more recently, right? Like I'm thinking the song Blurred Lines.
Yeah, that happened. I mean, I think they admitted that they were influenced by Marvin Gaye and that, you know, different things like that. But yeah, that's a really interesting case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you've just got to be careful. And that's what I teach my students, you know, and especially when it comes to sampling. You know, I don't do a lot of samples in my own music. But if you're sampling something, you've got to be extra, extra, extra careful, and you really need to get permission, you know, for whatever you're doing.
Is there some kind of rule where you can sample a certain amount of music without having to go for permission, or it's...
No. If you're sampling, that's a great question, but basically there's two types of copyrights, you know, not to get too, I guess, in the weeds, but there's a musical work, there's the melody and lyrics side of it, and then there is the sound recording side of it, which is like a particular recording. And if you're sampling something, you're really taking from both, but when you take from that sound recording side, the court has ruled that there's no amount that you can take. I mean, if you take 1 second, and even if you take it and you manipulate it and you pitch it down or you reverse it or whatever, if you take that, that's too much, says, you know, the court. Mm-hmm. But there's a defense called de minimis, meaning you're taking such a small amount that it's insignificant, that may be able to apply to the just the melody and lyric side of it. So if I just take like 3 notes from some song, I might be able to argue de minimis, that it's so small. But when it comes to sampling, at least the way the law is shaped right now, it's very strict. You know, mm-hmm. It's like you can't take anything without permission. You know, the law, the court case basically says if you sample, get permission or get a license if you're going to sample. Mm-hmm. So you got to be really careful. And I know some people try to sample and then hide it, you know, and try to, well, if you can figure it out, then good on you type thing. But
How does it work then if an artist samples somebody else's music? Does the original artist then get some royalties from that?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So if they sample someone else's music, you know, basically then it would become a derivative work. And the original artist would get royalties, you know, would be probably co-writer or however right. They would figure that out. But definitely. You can't, you know, take someone else's stuff and then just be like, this is my work, even though a lot of people think that's how that works, but but no.
So every time you hear Ice Ice Baby, Queen is getting a cut of that?
Yes, they should be. And that's a hilarious one. If you've ever seen Vanilla Ice try to explain the difference between his and theirs, it's really funny. Mm-hmm. And we were just watching that in class the other day, actually.
All right, so what's the next song you're going to play, Chris?
All right, the next song I'm going to play is called Famous Defenses. Here it goes. Shot down my famous defenses, keep you at a safe distance, 3 feet in personal spaces, closing in on me. Do 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 do. Da-dum, 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 I'm done pretending to be the perfect part of you. And how'd we miss such fragile targets, hold up right before us. Do 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 do. Da dum da dum da dum. Do 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 da dum dum. Da dum do.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Chris Nichols with a song there called Famous Defenses. So tell me about your songwriting process. For example, this song, how did you come up with the lyrics and the melody, and how did that whole process work?
Let's see. With that song, I think I just usually start with kind of a, like a, you know, it depends song to song. But with that one, sort of start with that, just that vibe of this, like especially this chord. It's a little bit unusual, I think, and it kind of gives me a vibe, what I'm going for. And then I start thinking about maybe a particular subject. So that one's famous defenses about maybe me being afraid to get close to mm-hmm. people.
So it's not famous legal defenses.
It is not about famous legal defenses, although I should change the words and, you know, mm-hmm. for my class. It's about, I think, my own personal defenses and being afraid to get close to somebody. So, you know, I usually kind of start with a premise or an idea like that and then just play, you know, the chords and kind of come up with that melody, you know. Come up with that and then sort of fill in, you know, like what words are working in there and then just fill it out to sort of tell a story, I mm-hmm. guess. So that one's interesting. And that one I wrote, you know, kind of later than the first song I played. And I've been tending to write songs that are, I guess, shorter. They're more like little ditties. You know,
right.
It's not so verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, like, very, you know, very structured. So it's just got, you know, it just repeats that chord progression. And then I just sort of throw in that da 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 da.
And if you were to kind of punkify that and speed it up, it would be a pretty short song, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be exactly. It'd be super short. Mm-hmm. So I think I recorded it, a version of it where I, you know, just took some particular lines and I sang it with a friend of mine named Erica. And she sang kind of high parts, and then I sang the lower parts. We harmonized and stuff. But we ended up, like, chopping it up and making it longer and throwing in some drums and mm-hmm. just extending it out. So that, what I just played, was really, you know, the meat of the song, you know, the lyrics, the melody, all that stuff. And then we, yeah, extended it out just to make it a little bit longer.
So if you perform, when you perform, you're usually performing with somebody else?
No. At the moment, I usually just perform acoustically. Mm-hmm. So I would just do the song just like that, short mm-hmm. and sweet,
yeah.
And then play another short and sweet song or something.
You were in a band before, though?
Yes. Before, I was in a band for many years. But it's just difficult. You know, I don't know if you've ever been in a band, you guys, but it's hard to get, you know, 4 or 5 people, whatever it is, to be on the same page all the time. It's sometimes
right.
hard to get them in the room at the same time. So at some point I was just like, you know, I guess I'll just go and do this myself, try to learn how to sing. I was never like the singer. I was always the guitarist. You know, that was my focus. And then I just, I guess, got used to my voice or was like, hey, I got to do this, you know. It'd be great to have a band, but I just think, especially with my schedule now, it'd be a little crazy. Yeah, do a lot of solo stuff now.
So tell us about the next song you're going to play.
Okay, so the next song is called Cigarettes and Stars. And this one is, let's see. Well, I was just thinking about this the other day, how I came up with this. But the name Cigarettes and Stars, I was hanging out with a friend of mine a long time ago, and she wrote a poem, and one of the first lines in the poem, or a line that stuck with me in her poem, was that someone threw a cigarette into a puddle, right, and the puddle was reflecting the stars of the night sky, or what have you, and then, you know, it says something about the cigarette and then hitting the stars, something like that, right? So I think I took that idea, cigarettes and stars, and then whatever, just sort of use that as like a jumping off point for the rest of this song.
We'll take it away.
Said the cigarette will reach the stars in the morning. She said these days will come and change your life with no warning. And if I take a chance, will be a big one. If I take a chance, I will. Mm-hmm.
said I'm light enough to show my scars, but that's boring. She said I'm dead enough to crash my car. You can't stop me. And if I take a chance, it'll be a big one. And if I take a chance, I will.
Well, Chris Nichols, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Creston. Our intern is Talia Blake. We're partway through our silent drive and we still need a little help to finish it off. So if you value local programming like Intersection, pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-800-785-2020. Or go to our website, wmfe.org, and make a contribution. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.